Well, hello everyone and welcome back to the Product Uncensored show. My name is Colin. I'm the host of this show and you are with me today on episode 42. We have super guests as well, as usual, right? And today our guest is from Thailand, someone who has done product at famous companies such as Spotify and Agoda. She's also the former chief product officer at Knock Knock, and she is now the CEO of her own startup called rKit. So I'm going to present you all to Nat Wongtosrat. So please welcome her to the show. How are you, Nat?
I should unmute myself.
Yes.
Hello. Hi, everyone. Wow. Good to be here. Thank you for having me here.
No problem. It's really good to have you on the show. We've been trying to sort of set up a time to make it work. Unfortunately, because of schedules and everything, had to postpone it once or twice. So actually, when I first reached out to Nat, she was, I believe she was still the chief product officer at Knock Knock, or I think she just left. And then in between all of that time, she has already started her startup. So I think we're going to talk a little bit about that. So I definitely would love to ask you a little bit more about that. But just as an introduction, you know, would love the audience to be able to know a little bit more about you. So if let's say I would say, Nat, what's the 30-second elevator pitch for Nat? What, you know, go.
Right. Okay. So current, I started my product journey in Spotify. I actually started as product manager. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I didn't start as a product manager from the start. I actually transitioned from finance before coming to product. And yeah, so I started moved to product in Spotify, working on a data analytics product. Making sure that our data analysts and data scientists at Spotify works better or works less, meaning they spend less time on the toolings and spend less time on the maintenance of that stuff. And then I moved back to Thailand. I was working at Spotify in Stockholm, in the headquarters, and then moved back to Thailand. I took on the role at Agoda, took more role on the leadership part of product, meaning looking more on the vision strategy, but still doing the shipping the product, doing the execution itself. And then I find myself thinking, how do I get better in terms of strategy, coming up with the tactics, coming up with the things that would make my product win. So I got a chance to actually know some great boss called Andy. He works in Singapore. He works in Yara Digital. Then I jumped there. And he taught me a lot on the strategy, product strategy, how do we actually win? And actually, we also touch the go-to-market side of things. So I kind of expanded a bit in each role, meaning I started as executor. And then I touched a bit on the leadership, how to manage people, and then on the strategy and the vision at Yara. And somehow I got a job landed at Knock Knock two and a half years ago as a chief product officer. But the tricky thing is it wasn't actually just product. It was product, tech, design, and data as well. So yeah, while I was actually working as product manager in all these companies except Spotify, since Agoda to now, actually, I was also working on a consulting on the side. So I help consult the startups outside my company. So I can actually learn a lot faster and more because I face a lot more problems than other product managers. And I think one of the saying that I find it very close to my heart is, not close to my heart, but I agree with it, is one of the Elon Musk saying that you actually get paid directly proportional to the difficulty of the problems you solve. So, and that's how I learned in product. that if you solve more problems, then you get more experience, then you become more, you can actually grow much faster. So that's me now. And currently I'm a chief executive officer, still not used to it. The CEO and co-founder of Arcad, doing fintech startup in Thailand. Actually, it's a global product, but we are based in Thailand.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you so much for that, Nat. I actually wanted to, I mean, I've got so many questions for you, right? But let me start with one which I think is really interesting. Because you had the opportunity to work at Spotify and you were in the Stockholm office, right? What made you decide to come back to Asia, right? Most people would, you know, prefer to, hey, you know, stay over there. Because obviously, I mean, not to knock on Southeast Asia or anything, right? But obviously the level of product maturity in the scene and opportunities, you know, in Europe and in US would seem to be more mature and better over there. So always curious to know, you know, what was your driving factor to come back to this side of the world?
Right. There are so many reasons. One of them is my health. Because after I stayed there for 8 years in total in Sweden, I've been through many of the companies. One of them is Klarna, as well as fintech, but I was not working in product. And after 7 years, the year seventh, I find myself allergic to pollen. Yes. And myself, I didn't like winter that much because of the dark and the cold. So I find myself struggling for 9 months in a year. So I decided that I would prioritize my health and my sanity. That's why I moved back. But that's the main reason. But I mean, coming back here is not as bad. I mean, looking at how mature the market in product management, how the structure of the company allows us to actually practice product management, it's not that far. But when you come back from those kind of background, you can actually build something here. So I'm doing a lot of things on the side. Consulting is one of them, and teaching product management as well. Making sure that we are in Southeast Asia are doing the right thing in product, because most of the people think of product as product manager, as product owner, coming from the textbook, like how do you mm-hmm. product ownership, or some people just took some courses and then try to apply into Southeast Asia. But that doesn't work, right? So I'm trying to be the advocate of how do you do product right? Yeah. So there's an upside as well, where you get to do things that really, if I'm in Stockholm, I might not be able to do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Really. I mean, sorry. Really sorry to hear about your health and being allergic to pollen. I was actually quite shocked because like 7 years and then suddenly you realize you're allergic to pollen, you know, you probably set your life up and everything. So that's quite tragic. But of course, the benefit is that, you know, everyone else in Southeast Asia gets to, you know, have a product leader like yourself coming back. So that's always good. So you mentioned, you know, how when you've done product right and then you come back, you can build something, you can sort of educate people. That's what you do. Consulting on the side. I think it'll be great if we could maybe just go down the rabbit hole there a little bit, right? What do you find the biggest bad habits for product folk, let's say in where you're based at in Thailand, right? Or maybe even when you're in Singapore, like what are the kind of bad habits that you find that, you know, we shouldn't be doing, or, you know, things that are, yeah, just not good?
What I see as something that happens all the time is whatever that is required from the stakeholder side of the company, product will just follow that without asking questions. And then what they would do is only look at the how should we execute this, How do we deliver this? How do we make sure that this is delivered in time? But that's not product management, that's project management, right? So yeah, that's what I see as the most common mistakes for product managers here, that always kind of a yes man. You just say yes to your stakeholders, yes to all the requests, yes to all the requirements. Yeah, so, and what they find that's fun within the role is how do we solve the problem? So I think that's one of the very, probably the junior product manager would do, but if you are getting into the mid-level or senior level, what you should do is to actually be a partner to your stakeholder. You think together, you bounce ideas. Oh, this is a great idea. What a problem you are solving. Are you solving the right problem? Are you solving the right target users? And then coming up with a solution together instead of just trying to, oh, take requirements is not enough. Give me more. So I think that's one of the common mistakes that I see. But what I'm thinking, I tried to actually understand why people, most of the product managers are like that here. I think what happens is the organizational structure in Thailand, they are not set up for product manager to be success. So most of the product roles are under either business or commercial, and there's a thin line between product and tech. And yeah, so they cannot do anything. What they can do is just receive the requirements and then send it over to the tech. So yeah, that's what I see. It's hard to tell the product managers that, oh, you shouldn't do this. You should be asking for the strategy. You should be asking for the problems. But I'm not sure if the structure of the company actually helps that or allows that. Yeah. Mm. So this is something I'm trying really hard to advocate for the companies to please, 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 if you are hiring product managers, please set them up for success.
Yeah, I think what you've mentioned, a couple of other guests have mentioned on the show before, but maybe as someone who does consulting on the side, maybe I can prod a little bit more. And where I want to go is the other side of the coin, right? Because I think you hit on something that's quite true, and I think not talked much about, especially within product circles in Southeast Asia, which is, sure, a lot of companies are realizing product managers are required, right? This role of product is key, right? You know, they are supposed to be understanding what the business needs, be able to spar, right? So to speak, to be able to negotiate and then take it back to the teams. But what I also find is that when you say that the organizations are not really set up to help the product team be successful, how do you do that when a lot of the education also needs to happen on the other side? So specifically what I'm talking about is if a company has been successful without the role of product, or they've managed to reach some level of success, and then they realize, you know what, I think we need product to really turbocharge us, take us to the next level, into the new era. But everybody else functions as if product isn't there, right? Like you're saying, business and commercial, they're doing everything. How do you do that? And maybe this is more coming from as a product leader, right? How would you do that? And what would be your advice for product leaders coming into that kind of a situation?
Right. So I can take two hats. One of them is from the consulting side. What I would do is to first find out what's the problem. They probably failed in some things, it tried and failed. That's why they hired me. So I would push on that. Why did you fail? What makes it, what was the kind of a culprit in the structure that actually didn't allow things to go further? So for example, actually it was pretty easy for me because Knock Knock used to be the setup like that. The setup was the tech team sit in India, and there's a product manager hat sitting in between, and there's a bunch of product managers sitting in Thailand. and then there's a business people sitting in Thailand as well. What happens is the product managers, the business people contact the project manager in India, give them requirements, and then tech team will execute it and send it back over in 2 weeks. And this is how we call Agile. So everything is wrong there. It's like a black box where you put in the input and then 2 weeks later, the output will come out. So when I tell this story to everyone, everyone is like, yes, this is what happened to us. And how did I change it? Then I tell the stories. Then I tell my story. And then for some reason, 95% of the people just buy and help me, help us change our structure into the way that you change Knock Knock Please. So that's how I start. I do it in my consulting. But how would I suggest people do it in the product leader side? There are many ways. One of the ways to hire me, but actually I have a lot of friends who is doing that, hired me, go in and talk to their C-levels. Why do we need to do that? And then after that, they execute it. But for me, I think on the product leader side, what they need to actually do is to make sure that the C-levels or C-suites understand why the setup needs to be like that. What's the pros? There probably are cons, but yeah, feel free not to mention it. But tell them why empowering the product managers would actually help them go further or faster or pivot faster. So that's a starting point. If the C-suite doesn't buy it, there's no point changing. There's no point trying to do it because at the end, they'll just roll it back to where it is. But most of the time, I think if people wanted to have product managers in their organizations, that means they see something in product. That means they read something from Spotify or from somewhere else. And they want it to be like that. They want it to be able to ship faster, fail faster, learn faster, right? So based on that, getting to the point where they feel that this is why we need product managers, try to change organization in a way that it will help products to success, to be successful. Yes.
Okay. Thank you so much for that. We're probably going to dive a little bit more into your Knock Knock story as well. So, but I'm going to leave that there for now. What I wanted to ask you, you know, since we started off the conversation talking about your time at Spotify and Stockholm as well, right, is in the last one, I think it was 2 years ago now, right? 1 to 2 years ago, where I can't remember what's the guy's name. Oh my gosh, let me go and find it. Jeremiah, I think, came out and talked about the now infamous Spotify failed, right? The Spotify model failing. As someone who worked in Spotify, did you experience, like, what are your thoughts on the Spotify model as someone who worked in Spotify? Yes.
Wow, will I get killed by my colleagues? ex-colleagues. So when I was there, I hated so much. I hated the model so much because there are a lot of flaws in the model itself. But not all of them. Some of them that I experienced was a flaw. For example, I was a product manager working with a lot of developers and designers. And what happens is, each of my developers reported to different engineering manager, which we called back then was a chapter lead. Yes, chapter lead. And when if we talk about the personal development or professional development of the developers, it's great, right? Yeah. But when it comes to the actual work itself, that happens, let's say this sprint doesn't work according to the plan because of 1, 2, 3, and 4. when I have a catch up with the chapter leads, it turns out that they have absolutely no idea what their developers has done or is doing. And I cannot actually consult with them or let's discuss on how we do better. Let's discuss on the actual work that is going to be shipped in the next sprint. And that's my pain point for a long time. And I try to talk to the, we have a mission lead, we have my manager as well. And yeah, and I think that's something Spotify experience, most of the squads in Spotify experience is that there's no one actually helping the developers on the work itself. So I feedback that to the team. And Spotify Way is a super flexible, everyone can do anything. Yeah. If you talk to one of the Spotifyer, you probably face some, you probably hear one story. If you ask the other one, you probably hear another story as well. So we do very different practice. We try to use the framework that they provided, but at the end, it's free for you to actually change into the way that it works for your squad. So after I talked to a few product managers if they have faced the same problem, and yeah, it's all similar. So what we did was that we did a little coup and say we need to change it. And one of the team that is another team alongside with my team, they changed it in a way that the engineering manager actually managed the whole dev team. My whole dev teams, and yeah, and that solved all the problems, including the professional development and the work itself. So, after 2 years, we actually shift. I think some of the tribe, it's been a long time. I forgot all the words. Some of the tribe actually changed into the model that has the engineering manager sitting with the squads instead of having the skill set management. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's one of the flaws that I think has to be fixed.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for sharing again, you know, the real stories behind, because again, you know, the Spotify model was like big news for a long time and everyone was talking about it. And of course, you know, everyone always had questions, right? I still remember because I was part of the Agile community over here in Malaysia, and I used to run events. And, you know, one of the people we invited talked about, you know, Spotify model. And of course, everybody goes gaga. Oh, but then you realize that, hey, you know, what about this? What about that? So personally, for me, when Jeremiah's talk came out, I was actually like, oh, okay, this makes sense on, you know, actually it was a working model that even Spotify themselves were still trying to figure out, whereas a lot of people receive it as almost gospel, right? Like, okay, you can take it and now this will make you faster, this will make you better. So and you know, to be able to speak with someone who actually went through that process is very very interesting for me, and I'm pretty sure everyone else who will be watching this will also be interested to hear, right, from someone who was actually living it and experiencing it. So thank you so much for that. Okay, so let us move on from Spotify. I one of the things that I really wanted to talk to you about is something that is something that I really like, but something that I also feel is very hard to implement at the stage of maturity, at least in my opinion, in Southeast Asia, which is being a product-led organization or product-led function. And in Knock Knock, when you were the chief product officer, that was something that you were trying to do. So can you tell us a little bit more about, like, you know, what was it that you were trying to achieve with being a product-led organization? One, and then secondly, you know, what were the steps that you did in order to sort of achieve that?
So product-led is actually my personal belief. Product-led was something Spotify has at its core, but it has never really core in terms of, oh, we are product led, because product is actually making all the decisions at Spotify. So I experienced that, and I feel that it's one of the best way to run the company, because product is the center. If the famous three circle, product is the center of everything, right? So since then, product led is my personal belief, where I think that if we are creating a valuable product through product excellence, then we can spend less money on marketing, we can have a word of mouth, we can grow the product without having to do other stuff, without having to do price war, without having to do things that we shouldn't do in a product management. So what I see as a product excellence is one, intuitive design. People come in, be able to use. So understand without having user manual. Yes, I think the phone back then, before iPhone era, all the phones, they have a thick manual, right? Because it's not intuitive for people. It's very difficult for people. Up until iPhone came out, there's little, very thin manual. So you see that, that's why iPhone is one of the favorite phone in the world, I think. I use iPhone, so maybe I'm biased. So how do you make sure that the intuitive, that the design is intuitive enough? And the second one is the essential features. You are releasing the features that people need, right? You're solving the pain point, actual pain point. And you are, the third one is you are surpassing the expectation of the people. There's a wow factor that comes with the product. There's nothing else that I think it should be there. You are developing the product that has these three components in the product excellence, and then you keep iterating and improving on it. So,
I just interrupt you for a while, Ned. I wanted to say something that I think will be pertinent to our viewers and listeners down the line, right? So Knock Knock is a marketplace, online marketplace as well. So just wanted to give the viewers and listeners a little bit of background before you continue. So sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. Right. Yes. I can relate it afterwards how we do it. Why do I think it's very, very important to be product led is because I think when you're creating essential features or the values that user would want without having to push it to the user, meaning your user would, oh, this is a great product, I want to use it. So you're really solving the user pain point, creating the difference in people's life. That's one. And the other one is, what I think it's very difficult for marketplace, which is Knock Knock, is you're always competing on the price, right? Because any other e-commerce marketplace, you have the same product, you have the same, there's no difference in the product itself. There's the actual product, not the platform. Let's say that, you're buying a television. It's the same. It's a Sony television, 50 inches. So you cannot actually differentiate on that. You have to differentiate on the platform experience or the logistic experience.
Ned, I think we are losing you. Are you there?
I am here. It was...
Okay.
Okay. Sorry. Internet today is really, really not cooperating with me.
It's okay, but we have you back now. Yeah.
Okay. Marketplace is competing on the price. So how do we make sure that we are giving the unique enough experience on the platform that user would not think on the price that much? That's what we are trying to go. And the third one is when it's product-led, not technology-led or not the business-led, it's really focusing on the user itself. It's really focusing on how do we solve the problem for the user. For example, if you are technology-led, and now there's an AI trend, right? ChatGPT and stuff. Most of the people would think, oh, AI is a trend now. How do we use AI to create a product better? But if you are product-led, it's more like, oh, we have this product. Can this be solved using AI? Yes, let's leverage it. So it's very different in a way that you think about it. So that's why I love product-led, and that's why I think it's a thing. If you are building a digital product, if you're building retail product, I'm not sure. But if you're building the digital product, I think it's very crucial that you start thinking about the product first, because product centered on the user, the pain point itself, including business and tech as well, but it's really trying to solve the problem rather than just riding on the wave that always change.
Yeah, I mean, I loved the way you positioned this whole conversation about AI, right? Because now it seems like the technology is the goal, not the enabler. And I've actually, so many years ago, quite a few years ago, even before the pandemic, I gave a talk about crypto as well. And I said the same thing, right? Now, you know, at that point in time, it seemed like crypto was the goal, as in instead of, you know, something that enables either transactions or, you know, the unbanked segment to get there. So I think, you know, I really align with what you've said. But here comes the kicker, right? It sounds really great. And, you know, people like you and me, it's like preaching to the choir. We would sit down and nerd out about this. But when it gets to the non-tech or the non-product side of things, that's when it starts being a little bit more difficult. So for example, like when you said, right, you know, let's say at Knock Knock, you're an online marketplace, and essentially you're going to be fighting a war of price. And the thing is that, but what you want to do is that you create a product that solves the user's problem so well that they would gladly pay for it. And unfortunately, on the business side, they're always thinking about it the other way around. How can I get you to pay for it to get it? How do you struggle through that?
That's a great question. It's really what I think it happens to all the marketplace, I would guess. What I call it to when we think about this and when we see suites discuss on things that we should do, what I call it as a term is that, yes, marketing, business, what you are trying to do is you are trying to hit the short-term goal. Because what we're trying to do is to make sure that we hit the GMV, we hit the revenue that we promise. That's it, right? But what product is trying to do is to make sure that after the short-term goal that we hit, we still can win in the long term. And that's how I try to make sure they understand that we are supporting, but at the same time, we also need some of the space to actually grow us in the longer term. And I think that worked well with the team, making sure that, oh, there's a balance between both of these. Sometimes it could be like 50-50% supporting business on the campaigns, on the promotions, on the things that we need to sell. And the other part is building on the features that would last longer than just promotional for the double-digit day, right? Sometimes it could be this month we are doing on the long term 100% because there's nothing on the short term side. But eventually is the understanding of the C-suites that if we are all focusing on the shorter term, then what happened after 2 years? What happened after 5 years? How do we win in the market? We are winning now. maybe we are taking all the market shares, but after the money is gone, after we cannot give the discounts anymore, what's next? So so that's how we discuss, and eventually we come to the conclusion that okay, product is doing product thing, leading on the side of longer term discussion. Commercial is doing commercial thing and leading on a shorter term discussion. Yes.
Mm. Perfect. So that leads me on to the next question. So as you can tell, you know, this is something that I read, you know, this is where I, you know, geek out, right? So another question, which by the way, just FYI, there's another event that's happening in KL that I'm moderating that's also talking about product led. So it just occurred to me yesterday when you know, I was thinking about, you know, today's show, and I'm like, oh wow, okay, I actually, you know, it's going to be very coincidental that these two events are going to be in the same week. So question sort of following this is, I really liked the way that you framed that product is focusing on the long term, you know, really focusing on the user and how to solve their problem, and obviously commercial side is usually focusing on the revenue, because that's the thing, right? You can't have just product led and no revenue, because otherwise the company would still die anyway. So it's a fair point. However, how then should we as product leaders, as product managers, frame the conversation such that, especially if you're in a position where the commercial teams are depending on the tech side of things to actually do something, right? Because that's the other conundrum. Yeah. You have a finite amount of bandwidth, finite amount of bets you can place. And now commercial team is saying, if you do this, this, and this, we're going to hit X amount of revenue. But we're saying that, hey, if you do this, this, and this, you may not see it in the short term, and you know, we can see it in the long term. And the thing is, I think the question I'm really trying to get at is, how do you build that habit of negotiation, I think? Because you can't also go into the meeting and say, from now on, you know, it's product led. So, you know, all you commercial teams go sit at the side and cry. That's not fair either, right? How do you build that muscle within the organization as product leaders?
Right. So there are a few things to this. One is the organizational structure. That's the first one. The second one is the we call it KPI, like metrics, the metrics itself. And the third one is, yeah, upskilling and reskilling. But let me come back to the organizational structure. So the way I set up the company or the structure and the product is I split it through user journey. So when the user comes in, what they find is first discovery. How do they discover us? SEO or direct search, or yeah, that's the first thing. Second thing is they find a product. So they found us. How do they find the product? How do they find their television? How do they find their sofa? So that's the second one. The third one is checkout itself. Once they pick what is it is, how do we make sure that the checkout is smooth? And yeah, and the rest after. But the first one, when people are searching for us, they're also searching for discounts, right? So there are teams that actually focusing on discounts, promotions, campaigns, and there are teams that focus on SEO, organic traffic. So paid traffic, organic traffic. And the goal for that campaign paid traffic team is to actually work with marketing. So the product manager has nothing else short term, only work on a short term thing. Mm. So usually we put a junior product manager there to be able to allow them to build the skill in execution, because they don't need to think about strategy, don't need to think about anything else, just execute it. So like the how that I talked about before. And when you grow a bit more into the role, you actually manage these people and you think more about how do I balance between the short term and the long term? How do I balance between taking the requirements and coming up with the requirements ourselves? So that's a structure that allows us to actually work on a short term. So I split the squat into short term squat and longer term squat. That's the structure. The second one is the metrics. So every for a team that's like checkout, they do a lot of how do I improve experience for people to have a smooth checkout, no friction, increase more payment method, or increase more logistic method, delivery method. So there you have both shorter term and longer term KPI, right? So how do they balance? That's on the metric. So at the start of the quarter, usually we do the vision for the product. Each different product has their own vision. Each different product has their strategy and has the metric attached to them. And they can probably have max like 2 or 3 metrics. That's it. That has to be shown to me. And those metrics will actually help them to understand what are the things that they should prioritize. For example, if this quarter, this team check out focusing on success rate, then all they need to do, all the features that they are releasing should be improving the success rate. And then maybe the second metric comes after if they succeed on this, the success rate of the payment, then they can continue to other stuff. And those metrics are aligned within the organization. So the product team has something called QBR, quarterly business review, where we tell the past quarter and we also tell the plan for the next quarter. And what's essentially very important in that meeting is you tell what's the next KPI that you are going to be measured on. Mm. And that kind of gives the North Star goal for the product team and also the stakeholders to understand, oh, this is the KPI for the team. Yes, this is what they are trying to reach in this quarter. So it's not a long term where you do the whole year and you cannot change anything else. It's a quarter where this is the focus of my team. And the next quarter probably give the product team inputs, then probably we'll be able to change it somehow or adapt it so that it's aligned with the business.
Okay, thank you so much for that. So follow-up question from that, right? You said you had squats that were short-term, squats that were long-term. So do you think, in your experience, in your opinion, that in order to be able to move towards a product-led organization, that you need to have a certain size? For example, let's phrase this example. Let's say you join Knock Knock and Knock Knock only had one squad for the buyer and only one squad for the seller, for example. So it's a marketplace, right? So seller, buyer. Do you think you would say that at that point in time, it's too small or it's going to be too difficult or you need to prioritize, you know, the short terms first? So again, I guess the main question I'm trying to ask is, you know, is there a certain prerequisite in terms of the size of the team before you can start considering seriously? Or if not, you know, should product leaders say, maybe not now?
If it's the product-led mindset, I wouldn't say that we need to wait for anything. If you have a product-led mindset, going back to what I mentioned before about product excellence, you build according to that. You don't build according to the price. You don't build according to the promotions. You build according to the design, the essential features, the wow factor, whatever it is. I don't think size matter to me, because that's the mindset of how you become product led. It's the thinking, but the execution is different, right? The execution itself is different. For example, if you are a company with 2 squads and seller and buyer, and the sellers need the feature to actually upload their product, but you said, no, I'm doing product led. I want to do something else. Then seller will not be able to sell the product.
You're still not solving their problem.
Yeah. But if you come back to the product excellence, when you talk about building something that's intuitive and essential feature, then actually those uploading the product will come into play, right? But if you are facing with, oh, do I build a product that helps with the upload of the bulk items, or should I go with the promotions? Then, yeah, that's something to be able, you should be able to understand sellers itself, themselves, whatever they want more. Yeah, so I think, yeah, size doesn't matter to me as long as you have that mindset and trying to execute it. Maybe it's not perfect. Maybe sometimes you need to listen to the commercial team. Sometimes you need to listen to the tech team a lot more, or just follow them because you don't know what's you don't have the data to actually come in and say that, oh, this is the right way for us. Then probably, yeah, that's mindset is there, but how much, what's the percentage that you can actually execute it? It's, yeah, maybe progress when the team starts to be bigger or you have more data to actually back you up.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for that. I wanted to switch gears a little bit. We've talked about Knock Knock a lot. I actually wanted to talk a little bit about your new venture as well, right? I guess starting question is, what made you decide to leave, you know, everything that you've built in Knock Knock and start over? You know, I mean, essentially you're starting from zero again, right? What was it that, you know, you decided, you know what, I want to do this?
Yes. So talking about the new company first, it's called iCat. It's a fintech company where we focus on trading. What's different from other people is that we are doing tokenization of the real asset, meaning we are issuing the tokens for all the stocks or the real estate. So now you actually unlocked almost everything, right? You can buy stocks around the world, you can buy real estates around the world, you can buy commodities around the world without having to go do paperwork, a lot of paperwork that it's headache for everyone because of the international laws, those kind of things. So yeah, we are trying to leverage the technology, which is called blockchain, to come in and make sure that people in the real world can use it. So the amazing thing of this product is that most of the people that wanted to buy something along this line needs a MetaMask. I'm not sure if MetaMask is too painful, but MetaMask is another wallet that it's very, very complicated for majority of the people. Yeah. And what we are doing is that we are building a platform to allow the trading, and we are also building the wallet, embedded wallet within the platform as well. And we are going gasless as well. In a blockchain world where you do transactions, you need a gas, right? We are doing gasless. So experience of the user on a platform itself, it's very like Web 2, meaning it's really like doing the traditional trading. Mm. You just click on the stocks that you want to buy, you click buy, you just see the fee. You just see the trading fee. You don't see gas fee. You need to convert into Ethereum. You don't need to convert into anything. Bitcoin, so we are bringing Web3 technology that we see as something that can unlock stuff in the world into the Web2, where most people still here. Most people are still in Web2. And trying to make sure that the experience that they are having with us is the same as traditional platform, but you are actually leveraging the new technology that the world has. So, yeah, it's like AI, how do you integrate AI into the product without having people to do the prompt, right? So very similar idea. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's the new business. Why did I move here? Why did I start my life all over again? I think there are many things. I've been with this product for a year now. Been doing it on the side, 7 to 9 p.m.
Wow.
So I've been doing this for a while now, and I felt like it's going to make a really a lot of impact to the people and to the world, because I really believe that investment is difficult and high barrier in the current state of the world. How do we actually try to make it simpler? And by simpler doesn't mean that you need to do it simple, meaning you trade in the country, you trade the market that you have. How do we make it simpler but still complex, right? So it's a mix of a very, very interesting product problems where I find this is what I want to do. And since I said that, I've been working with this for a year. The team that we're working on this, it's awesome team, meaning we are using one of the most advanced tech stack. That means that the tech team is very, very, like, very advanced, very, like, awesome. Mm. We can actually integrate something that other big banks has used 9 months, I think, but we did it in 3 months. So that proved a lot of like capabilities in tech teams where you cannot really find it elsewhere in Thailand. And the product idea that actually helps the world, and it's not easy to do. And if we can do it, I think it's going to be phenomenal somehow. And one of the last thing that I learned so far after working for how many years now, I forgot, I wanted to do a global product.
Wow. Okay.
And this product is global. So I want to make sure that we are not just serving specific group of user in specific demographic or country. I want to make sure we are targeted to a specific group of user, but globally.
Wow, very nice. I was just going to ask you about, but then, you know, if you're targeting everybody, then you're targeting nobody. So yes, thank you for coming up with that last line. So, okay. I guess it's slightly unrelated question, right? Because obviously you're leveraging on blockchain and you're building, you know, your token within embedding the wallet within the platform itself. I'm just curious to, like I said, this is not exactly related, right? But we've had some of the like worst news coming out of the crypto scene recent times, right? You know, CZ just stepped down with the whole debacle at Binance. And before that, it was, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried. So do you feel that, you know, this is something, another challenge that, you know, Arket is going to have to sort of try and you know, do take in your stride? Or do you feel like, no, that doesn't really impact, you know, the product that you're building because it's not directly related?
I think it's directly related in terms of the user. People don't really differentiate between, if it's a crypto, they just put us in the same bucket, right?
Yeah.
But what we are trying to do is to make sure that we fill the gap of things that happened in the past that makes it not ideal. For example, crypto trading or Terra, Luna, it's because it's not based on the real world asset, right? Yes. It's some coins that people just buy and sell. It's like going into casino, betting that the red color would win. So what we're trying to do is to use the technology, but you are actually trading on the value of the real world asset.
Mm.
So you're trading on actual Tesla stock. You are actually trading on Microsoft stock, the value of that. We are not creating any other values from the token that we are selling. We are using the real value or the real price of the stocks, just making sure that people around the world, with or without account, complicated banking account, or overseas account, can trade. So kind of, this is something that we as a company need to be able to explain to the user that you are not just trading coins, you are buying the real stocks.
Mm.
So that's one. The other one that I think is on the CC side, very interesting, but I think Binance has been doing a lot of things behind the laws, behind the legality of the countries. For example, in Thailand, they are actually not legalized. So before this, they are not legalized to sell to Thai people, but they did it anyway. But now I think they are legalized. But what we are trying to do is to make sure that we are not stepping over to that space. We are under regulation or the countries. We are going to be registered in Singapore. We are going to be registered in Dubai to make sure that all the license that we are, everything that we are operating, we have the license for it. And we are also partnering, and they are also our investor, one of the brokerage securities in Thailand. So on the legal side, we are covered. We make sure we're covered. So there's nothing like what's happened in the world.
Okay. So sorry, again, I think this is good for everyone to understand, given the mission that you have for Arket. Does that mean that the product, when you're purchasing, because you're saying you're basing it on real life assets, does that mean that it doesn't need to go through a crypto exchange? Are you like purchasing directly? How does that work?
You need to go to crypto exchange. What we are doing at the behind the scene. So let's say, Colin, you're buying Apple stocks, right?
Yeah.
When you purchase a stock, what we do behind the scene is we go and buy actual Apple stock.
Yes.
And then put it on our side. But what you're buying is the token itself. Why do you token? First, it's fractional. So if you say that, oh, I don't want one, it's too expensive, I want just half of it, you can buy half of it. And what's next is what we are trying. This is the next feature that might come like in 2 years, is that we wanted people to be able to collateral on the assets that they have. Meaning you bought an Apple, you are 100,000 of Apple. Most of the ports, you will just sit there, right? The value, the asset will just sit there. But how do you make sure that it can be like a car or a house where you can collateral and you get the cash out without having to sell the stocks? So that's why it's being tokenized.
Wow. Okay. Oh, this is really cool. We're almost out of time, but thank you so much for spending time so far, you know, explaining, you know, and dealing with all my incessant questions. I actually had another curious question for you. You know, you being, you know, a very product person, you know, you've obviously achieved a lot, you know, in product leadership. How are you planning to build that product practice within Arket as well, right? Because now you're the CEO, you're no longer the chief product officer. What are the things that you feel that you want to implement in Arket that you couldn't do, or you know, maybe not to say couldn't do, but it wasn't a priority or something that was overlooked, especially from a product perspective, you know, as the CEO, right? Because now the hat is a little bit different.
So first thing we agreed when we started the company, right now we have almost 30 people already. It's very fast. We agreed that this company is a product-led company. Everyone is excited for that. Everyone agree with the mission, and everyone that will join in the future will have to agree to this. Mm. So that's the first thing. Yes. And right now we have just two C-suite. One is me, CEO. The other one is the chief product and tech officer. We don't even have a CFO. We don't even have the commercial, because I think that this is how we built the culture. We started with
All right, Nat, I think your internet has
and we build the culture from there.
Okay. All right. Sorry, you just lost you just for like two seconds. Yes, you're back. Okay. Sorry.
Oh, continue. Okay. And yes, and so those are the first few things. Make sure that people understand what is product-led, and make sure that the leadership is coming from product and tech and the CEO. And what are the things that I wish I could do but not being able to do was more on the culture side. I mean, the culture within Knock Knock, as a product-led company or product-led organization within the product itself, it worked well. But still, the culture outside, the other departments, they still don't really fully grasp what is product-led. Mm. So right now, as a CEO, what I wanted to do is to make sure that the whole organization understand, or the whole organization actually adapt to the culture of product-led. Because being product-led is not like you just put a product there, make sure they are empowered and they can lead, right? You need a follower that is actually a follower as well. You need a people who can support. You need a people who understand the process of doing this and then do it along with us. So that's something. It wasn't really my control, and now I want it to really happen and make sure. Another thing that I talked to my with my co-founder, who's the chief product and tech officer, is that we really want it to be one of the first Southeast Asia startups that becomes like Spotify. Like, everyone wants to follow us. Like, everyone wants to understand how we did it and copy us and paste it into them. So that's our that's our goal. Very, very, it's an aggressive goal, but
Yeah, I think it's great. And you know, this is why I feel, you know, I've said this for a few years now, that I think Asia, especially Southeast Asia, will be a very interesting place to be, especially from a product perspective, you know, the practice of product and product management in the next few years, because I think this is where all the interesting developments are going to be. And I'm always grateful to hear that, you know, leaders like yourself and all the other guests on the show, you know, they continue to come back and invest into this region, right? So that, you know, not everybody has to go and leave to go and get that kind of an experience. So we're pretty much out of time, Nat. So again, thank you so much. Is there anything that you would like to leave as a final note, or, you know, a piece of advice for anyone that's, you know, watching this episode? Is there, you know, are there any final thoughts?
Oh, this is the hardest. I think product management is still very, I mean, product management itself on it's not fixed, as it's not set in stone, right? If you read something you think is cool, ask yourself, why did they do it? What's the objective of doing that? And try to get the objective or the reason that they do it and apply to the team, rather than just copy whatever they did. Like, Spotify did this whole agile team, and you just paste it here. Ask yourself, why did they do it? And take the reason and apply to your team. That will help you understand and make sure that you don't fail because it just copies something that doesn't work in your company.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Nat. Well, everyone, that was Nat Wontrostrat, the CEO of Arket, previous ex-CPO at Knock Knock, someone who's had so much experience. As usual, I really enjoyed the conversations. And yeah, you know, if you do have any questions or something, you know, by the time this episode goes out, and I also publish this on all social media, you know, please feel to interact and ask, and I'll make sure that they get to Nat as well. But if not, I still haven't decided whether there will be one more episode for the end of the year because it's going to be quite a busy end to the year. So hopefully there'll be one more. I still have one guest that I'm hoping to get on the show for December. So until the next show, please hang tight, and I hope that everything is going to be good for everyone. Have a good day. Bye-bye.